Natalie Fenton from Goldsmiths College, University of London, and I would probably describe myself in relation to those last categories as a political activist that crosses over all of those areas whenever I think it's strategically useful to do so in various different contingencies. I would also describe myself as a public intellectual, and of course my primary occupation, or not one that occupies most of my time, is as an academic. And this paper today, I'm not going to use any PowerPoint or anything. One of my students recently said to me, you know, Natalie, PowerPoint is so 90s, and we really prefer it when you just talk to us. So I've used that as my excuse ever since, actually, not to use it. So I'm just going to talk. But this paper really comes out of my frustration through my political activism and the desire to try and move the debate on a bit, recognising all the things that Daniel has just said in many ways, and the complexity and the fluidity and all the issues that rises, but still being left at the end with the problem of impatience, really. It's my political impatience. But when are things really going to change? When are the real challenges to sort of capitalist approach really going to materialise and take hold? And although the paper I'm going to give now is largely theoretical, which will seem a bit odd in terms of that introduction, that's because I also get frustrated in my political activism of that gap between theory and action that I always seem to be struggling with. So the title of the paper is Contesting Global Capital, New Media and the Role of the Social Imaginary. Because I feel that I need, or that we need, or that the world of political activism that I operate within needs something more to hinge onto than just multiple fluid identities that come in and out of existence at any one time whenever it's useful, and do things on a very local basis, sometimes national, sometimes global, but that actually there's no sense of real coherence to much of that. And I struggle with that. Maybe that's just because I'm an old-fashioned, traditional political activist, but I think there's something more to it than that. So I start from the base point that social and political activism is changing. It's changing in fairly radical ways. We'll hear lots about that this conference. And that's not just to do, of course, with new technology, although it is sometimes to do with that. But it's also to do with the big factors, the macro factors of economic globalization, the deregulation of the media, increasing concentration of wealth and power, and increasing inequalities. It's also to do with the shrinking, I think, of public space in communications. The digital explosion reminds us, of course, that there are all these different ideas and identities floating around all the time. And those different ideas and identities do give us a degree of freedom, of autonomy, of ability to recreate ourselves, to position ourselves in various ways at various points. And that they operate and function in some ways quite successfully alongside the social construction of identity and behaviour that Daniel also spoke about in that sort of, the more traditional dominance ideology model, really. And I'm interested in the tension between those two areas. What does the construction, the social construction that happens through the dominance of capital, how does that infiltrate into all those other activities? And to some extent, how can it not necessarily overwhelm, but smother to some degree our ability to create this social imaginary so that we can actually transcend capital? What is it, if everything becomes commercial in and of itself, if we are these political actors who are operating much more on the basis of consumption rather than production, what does that say about the sorts of activity and the sorts of conclusions for that activity that come out? And I start with one quote from Zizek, which is old now, it's 1999, but to me it's still entirely relevant. Maybe it's not really possible, at least not in the foreseeable future, to undermine the global capitalist system because we cannot imagine any alternative to it. Now, actually, lots of alternatives are out there, but it's still very hard to see that outside of a sort of utopian or sort of really very, very extremely optimistic frame. And I'm interested in that transcendent quality, and I'm interested in the notion of utopia and the capacity to move from just being a resistant identity into being a political project, and how we can do that. And some people I know here will argue that, well, that's irrelevant, actually. We've moved on from that already. That's not the point. I would actually argue, I don't think we have, and I think we need to hang on to it. The aesthetics and form of new media, because we're talking particularly here about the use of the internet, can break the mould in very many ways. It's useful to think of it in those terms, to think about how political discourse and rhetoric has changed in relation to that. We know that new media, the internet in particular, is suggestive of the end of linearity. Things happen in a webbed fashion, which is all, you know, sort of a neat corollary to the end of the meta-narrative and modern ways of thinking about and political transformation. As a communication process, it's additive, it's interactive, and it's always unfolding. Again, that's very well suited to the fluidity of social movement politics. That notion that it's open communications, it's open protocols, it's self-generating identities. But it's also localized, fragmented, disaggregated, and divided. And it's that sort of, you know, juggling those two things. How, for me, yes, I can recognize all the good points, the advantages in being fluid and unstable and disaggregated, but where will a political project emerge from that, and how will that happen? And what I want to do is talk through some of the issues that that begins with. One of the things that I would say is that you have to be able to imagine an endpoint somewhere down the line that will gain solidarity, collective political uprising, really, in relation to that. So the internet acts in all those ways, because of all its form and aesthetics, as a facilitator of international protest. We know that. And it does that for various reasons, but, you know, obviously because it's global, because it's immediate, and all those issues that lots of people have spoken about before. But it also creates a dialectic relationship between the material and the virtual. The two impact one upon the other, and sometimes that's forgotten. That actually our life as activists online has an effect on our life as activists in the material world. When we're going on demonstrations, when we're doing our political activism in the real world, that's impacted on by what's happening in that virtual world. Similarly, the organisation and structure of our virtual politics is impacted on by who we're talking to, what meetings we're going to, what demonstrations we're attending. So what that's very simply saying is, here we have a technology with the potential to communicate and mobilise political agency and reinvent activism. But it's not, sort of, doesn't exist out on a limb or all on its own. The democratic potential of the internet isn't dependent on its intrinsic features. It's realised only through those agents who engage in it. And those agents need to engage in a reflexive and democratic way, however we like to define democracy. So the internet is susceptible to any other structuring forces of power, any of those structuring forces of power, any other technology. We know that, but we have to always remember it. So when we're talking about this multiple, fragmented, dispersed group of political activists and activisms that's going on all over the globe, you also have to ask that other question. Is that ultimately rendered irrelevant by the increasing tide of neoliberalism or ever greater privatisation? And I think some of the ways, there's obviously a debate that Daniel and I will have about this later on, is that I think lots of the things, the ways he was describing the publicness of governmentality or whatever across the globe, it's actually, you could also see in quite different ways. You could define that in quite different ways. So we come back to that age-old tension between structure and agency. And I can't really escape that. How is this commercial consumer citizen that many of us now are in, certainly in sort of developed capitalism, how do we operate our political identities within that? And I go back to Foucault's, of all people, Foucault's concept of biopolitical production, and that's been reinterpreted by various political theories now. And what that's saying, and it's the thing that I struggle with, is if we're talking, part of the reason these multiple fragmented dispersed identities exist is because the politicization of our social life has changed. It is based on identity politics now. Can identity politics ultimately transform, engage with social progressiveness at some level? That's a question I'm asking. I don't necessarily know the answer. It does some things, but ultimately to me, sort of the machine of capitalism remains relatively undented. In this notion of biopolitical production, the economic, the political, and the cultural feed off each other at all times. And what happens then is markets and politics intertwine, and we get what can be called market-based activism. So what appears to be political is actually potentially no more than just having a civilizing effect on the market. It gives us the illusion of democracy. It makes us feel good because all of us who want to create social change about this say, look, all of this is happening. We go to all these meetings and all these demonstrations. Isn't it fantastic? But actually, all it does is have that notion of democracy in action, whereas actually, when you look around, what is fundamentally changing? So all these proponents of biopolitics will state that new forms of social militancy are allowed to arise within capitalism, but they have no possibility of transcendence, that notion of transcendence coming back to. On the other hand, you get those theorists who will talk about the move from a struggle around production to a struggle around circulation, of which the internet is centrally implicated. So if we move to the notion of a struggle around circulation, and the internet evolves, is involved in the ever more efficient circulation of information, then that, we could argue, actually does open up potential for strategies of resistance and strategies of alternative politics. So as we move from that notion of the accumulation of wealth, that struggle being focused around the accumulation of wealth, to more the circulation of information, we can begin maybe to see it in a more positive light. Social movement organisations communicate largely through this circulation of struggle. That benefits hugely from fragmentation. It benefits hugely from being inclusive, from being able to be diverse, from being able to capture very many voices within sort of diffuse political notions and political activism that's out there. They're large, decentralised, leaderless networks which can operate on this sort of politics of participation of everybody. Everybody's getting involved, rather than that old-fashioned traditional notion of hierarchical politics that is sort of very much firmly based around leaders. So I want to embrace that notion of difference and diversity. And if we accept that possibility for resistant, differentiated, individual political identities that can create their own political interventions via the internet, then we can start talking about the prospects for emergent political projects. But for political efficacy, I think there has to be more than just the apparent freedom that comes with embracing difference and diversity. I think we have to think beyond that, and it's more than just having multiple acts or multiple sites of resistance. If we accept the description of society as fragmented, then to create a viable political community has to have something like that old-fashioned modernist concept called solidarity. And I think that's the socio-political glue that will prevent sort of a dissolution through difference. You know, lots of different things all making us feel good, but actually may result in a sort of just competition of victimizations ultimately. And so I move on in the paper then to talk about the role of solidarity. How can we begin to talk about solidarity in this new environment? Solidarity reaffirms the need for political intervention. It puts the emphasis back on the political, I think. That can be translated and relayed in this symbolic world, symbolic immaterial world of cyberspace. But importantly, it originates from and solidifies in the material world. So So cyber politics and place politics work together. And, you know, this means that people are maybe rooted in sort of very national context, very local context within that sort of national, local, national, global nexus with many, many others will be rooted in national context. But we can be involved in transnational networks, very much what Saskia was saying this morning. And that allows us to have multiple belongings and flexible identities. Those collective identities are seen to increase in solidarity in the active participation in offline protests. There's an awful lot of social movement theorist research that talks about how actually solidarity, collective identity, is increased mostly through meetings or face-to-face interactions offline, not online. And that effectiveness of the internet as virtual activism thereby lies in really in its ability to connect with the real world. I liked very much this morning Saskia's description of thin sociality going on, or you know, what exactly is happening. Because there are very different levels, of course, of this occurring. And maybe I think the notion of solidarity is much, it is trying to for a much deeper understanding of that, or maybe a more solid understanding. So solidarity in this new way of conceiving of it is no longer about links in a chain, that old-fashioned modernist way of understanding how solidarity operated, but it's communicating in a sort of viral web-like fashion, facilitated by information and communication technologies. Now the virtual, it's important here that we don't then start thinking of the virtual as being something entirely different to the material. I'm aware that you know, when you start saying, oh, but offline and online protests are entirely different, they operate in different ways, well, that's not necessarily true. The virtual isn't unreal, I'm not arguing that, and it doesn't function to sort of inculcate a derealization either. But the virtual, and the virtual does promote political consciousness, reflexivity, and agency. So the virtual and the material actually interact and overlap in many more ways. And if you conceive of the virtual and material as shaping each other in terms of organisational structures, network stability and capacity, political capacity, then it becomes a much more interesting way to theorise and opens up conceptual possibilities. And the internet, I think, allows solidarity to perform in certain ways. It becomes a performative experience of solidarity. And that is relayed to us through the felt existence of struggles that are situated in the real material world of poverty, of inequality, and other social injustices. So it's very far away from being a technological determinism. Although, you know, I'm recognising the form and function of the internet as being integral to new forms of activism, I'm not saying that, you know, it can exist just around and is determined by that technology. As I've said before, you know, it's only democratic. It'll only advance a political project insofar as the people who are speaking to it or engaged with it also operate in a democratic fashion. And often, it's far from democratic. I think we need to be conscious of that as well. So if this immaterial mediated world of the internet embraces fragmented political subjectivities, connects with material world at the site of conflict, bringing together disparate experiences of political reality and finding common ground, which even though that ground may be uneven, contested, and complex, what sort of issues does that raise for us? These individuals all operate within a context that is determined by fixed temporal, spatial, and material constraints. And they themselves are obviously a product of contingent social, political, and cultural forces. And I can't get away from the fact that issues of culture and capital are ever prevalent. They're always there. So new media can become the location for counter-reflexive political deliberation, but only if the desire and the deliberation and the self-reflexivity also exists outside in the material world. We could have all this solidarity operating online, but so what? Actually, who gives a monkey? What's going on with it? What's actually happening? Solidarity alone does not make a political project. I think that's part of my whole underlying sort of concerns with a lot of this. Can loose multi-issue networks progress from this resistance identity to a political project that is sustainable, that's likely to produce socially progressive transformation and political transformation? Can we move to that point? And this is where I come to the notion that I think the role of a social imaginary, what I term a social imaginary, is critical. There are lots of problems with internet activism, I think. Partly because it tends to be very short-term and rapidly shifting issues. It's often fleeting and requires momentary support. So we dip in and out, we do our little bit, and then we go off and we perform what we do 99% of the time in our other lives. Whereas network communication may enable the success of campaigns, can networks without this political project sustain any degree of political coherence? If we're just dipping in and out as individuals, you know, and the internet encourages that in some way, shape, or form, where will the bigger political picture come from? And this again, you know, I think I'm an old-fashioned idealist, and I think I'm just going to have to accept that I can't move on from that. But you know, I still struggle to find how it's actually going to really, really move on. We're talking a big change way, whether it's reform or revolution, but it's a big change way. So can this networked, polycentric, global civil society movement deliver on policies, on strategies, on plans for socially progressive change? And my concern is that actually, in attempting to avoid a politics of old, that's based on binary oppositions, it's based on sort of essentialist notions, exclusionary meta-narratives, are we going to end up sort of biting off our collective noses despite our individual faces? Really, is that where we're going to end up? Because actually, in that complex of local, national, global, many of us, and many of the politics that we engage with still exist, actually, or still are framed by the sovereignty of the nation state. It's still very difficult to have global impact on, you know, in terms of change on a social and political level. So does a lack of ideological rigour allow for a broader network creating a vast web of oppositional politics, or does it rather prevent conflicts and differences being confronted and engender other problems of accountability and control that go with that? Whereas, you know, I can understand and embrace that notion that because it's inclusive, because it's fragmentary, it allows a broader politics to develop and emerge. But on the other hand, I say, yeah, but you know, as we can dip from one bit to the other all the time, so I don't like that, I'll just go and talk to them over there. We never actually get to a point of resolving conflicts, differences, and moving forward. The dialectic sort of stops in fragments, and that's my worry. So I want to go from counter-publicity and the many and varied counter-publics that exist to social transformation, to bring back in the notion of a battle of ideas as being critical to the political project. Building collective solidarity is about organisational capacity, but it's still very crucially about ideas. And maybe this is where we need to start talking again about types of utopianism. Ruth Levitas, as a political scientist who I like, her work I admire a lot, talks about the need for a dialogical utopianism. You know, we need to have to bring in, to start talking about a third differentiated notion of post-capitalist society that can embrace difference, but nonetheless is saying there is a way forward in which, you know, we need to start naming it a bit more, I think, and not be too embarrassed to do that. It needs to be flexible, it needs to be inclusive, it needs to be visionary. But it needs to, critically, to offer us all a hope, a vision of a better tomorrow. Otherwise, I think we will lose the new political activists of the future. Thank you.
One or two quick questions?
We have more time for questions at the end of the session.
No, we will not, because I discovered that all four speakers are here.
But later on this afternoon
is when we have the discussion session.
Well, I have a question, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe it's in the form of remark, but a question is, Since we're in Hungary now, it's post-socialist country, let's say, and it's...
So we're here, yes.
Yeah, and I didn't hear anything about, like, not transition, but new democracies, emerging democracies. You both spoke about rich countries will establish democracies and basically trying to establish something extra to what already exists. And I think there is a problem here because actually in Hungary as well, it's part of the world, you know. This mechanism which is available in London, I mean, I've seen a lot of people protesting against anything, you know, just in front of parliament, which are not possible in other parts of the world. So basically, why would you need internet as an extra tool if you can do this with traditional media? I mean, and also BBC, like you said, is BBC. Well, you can go on BBC and like petition them or write them, you can be sure it will appear there because you pay for them, right? You pay a little money and it's public television and you're sure. So you can use the traditional media. So this is extra. It's like a kind of a toy, you know. But it didn't mention that in some countries it's the only way to express your opinion. Well, in a way, you know, in many parts of the world. I'm originally from Russia, so I know how it feels. Which media can you address with your idea about something that goes wrong? I mean, if it's between kind of two oligarchs and the state. So the internet is the only place. But you didn't say anything about that. So how do you feel about that?
I think that's right. In many places, I mean, I would include the UK in that. But actually, if you really have, you know, sort of radical alternative views or that you want to be talk about at any length, then you have to use alternative media. I think the mainstream media has closed down, and unless you want to speak their language and play their game, in which case you get a complete watering down of your whatever you want to say. And there are reasons to do that because you might want to talk to that type of public or that type of audience, but otherwise the internet is the place to do that, and it's the place to talk and build those collective identities, to find out what else is going on in the world. But it's there are limits to how far that's useful.
But you said radical news. What is radical news in your country? Illegal or something?
Well, illegal might be radical, not necessarily that's it. Talking about ideas which may be entirely contrary to the status quo or the consensus.
Here we have
current consensus.
Second question. You can pursue this. This is a good issue later in the discussion session. Yes.
Following the notion of the dialogical
utopianism,
could you cite a project, a practice that appeals to you about that regard, and that is in some way transformative, in other words, that it relates to the spaces of government and policy. I don't know, for example, within British government practice, policy formation by consultation, and I think I'm correct that multi-stakeholder theory seems to be at the core of that. So would you have an example, that's the question, of something that's a dialogical approach, is a utopian venture itself, impacts on the dominant policy government space? And I hope the question makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense to me. I'm not sure I have an example. And that's part of my concern, is that actually I'm not necessarily sure that does happen out there. The politics that I've been engaged in at all different sorts of levels, from sort of more grassroots right through to sort of detailed interactions with government ministers and lobbying them that way, I never felt that I've been in that dialogical role. I've never felt engaged.
But you're having a genuine dialogue between...
Okay.
I think it's happening a lot, but it's very difficult to name it because it's diffuse, it takes a bit of time, it may break down, you know, there are incompleted projects. I would not, just because we can't think, any of us here, evidently, of a good, sharp example, you know, that doesn't mean that it isn't happening and that it might not be very productive. I mean, I find utopianism, it's always a bit elusive, you know? Sort of, how do you know, really?
Well, a good example of this kind of discursive public would be the attempt by the political right in Canada to reduce gay rights, lesbian rights, and the dialogical project would be of great success would be that the Canadians rejected this, right? Because the nature of the dialogue is between two, but is also with many. So when we look, when my point about social values is that Canadians were given a choice between a kind of a Bush-style social revolution and entrenching in the Constitution gay marriage and gay rights. They chose to vote. They chose to support gay marriage and gay rights. Now, this is an interesting, because this is an, I find this a bit abstract. I think we should try to be more concrete about the nature of these discursive publics. And because they're different.
Let's get into this afternoon, especially session, and let's have this daily, and you will briefly introduce.